I would like for you to turn with me to Matthew chapter 16. Matthew, the 16th chapter. And we see in verse 21, Jesus teaching his disciples what he will do to save mankind. Somebody has called this the four necessities of redemption. We read in verse 21, from that time forth began Jesus to show unto his disciples how that he must go unto Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised again the third day. The four necessities of redemption. Then you get on to verse 24, and the first word of verse 24 is the word then. So if we're going to understand verses 24 to 28, which is my text this morning, we must start with 21 to 23, because Jesus says then, or it says then in verse 24. So let's go back to verse 22. Right after Peter hears the Lord give the four necessities of redemption, he protests. Then Peter took him and began to rebuke him. Can you imagine that? Somebody rebuking Jesus, saying, "Be it far from thee, Lord. This shall not be unto thee." That phrase, "be it far from thee," has this idea. May God be merciful to you. And it's a double negative when he says, "This shall not be unto you." We don't speak in the double negative today. But in the double, when the Greeks would, if they would use two negatives, they meant it for emphasis. So Peter is emphasizing and saying, "Lord, there is no way this is going to happen to you." And some of us would say, "Oh, Peter, he has such a good heart. He has the best for Jesus in mind." But I want you to see what Jesus says in reply. "But he," Jesus, "turned and said unto Peter, Get thee behind me." Would you please read out loud what he calls him there? "Satan, thou art an offense unto me, for thou savorest not the things that be of God, but those that be of men." That word "savorest" means you're not thinking on the things of God. Now, just a moment ago, I was saying that we would often say, "Well, Peter has the best in mind for Jesus." And Jesus is saying, "You don't have the best in mind. You do not savor the things that are of God. You are savoring, you're thinking on the things of men." And Jesus tells him, "Go away behind me." Literally, "Get thee behind me." Go away, get behind me. And then he calls him Satan. Peter rebukes Jesus. Jesus says to him, "You get behind me, Satan." And tells him he is being used of Satan to set a trap. Now, Peter is one of the disciples. Peter is a good man. Folks, do you realize that sometimes the devil uses those who are closest to us to cause us to go astray? That Satan may use someone who is your best friend. He may even use a spouse. Unwittingly, the spouse, but nevertheless being used to turn us away from what God has in mind for us. And so Jesus gets to the real problem with Peter in verse 22. When he says, "You are not thinking of the things of God, but you are thinking of the things of men." Your thinking, Peter, reflects that of men. It does not reflect the thinking of God. And to such people today, Jesus would say to you, as he does to Peter in verse 23, "You get behind me. Go away, get behind me, Satan." Folks, if your thinking is not on the things of God, but on the things of men, you have the Peter problem. And the next verses that we're going to see in verses 24, 25, 26, and 27, in those verses, Those, what Jesus talks about there, will go against your natural processes of thought, of thinking. It'll go against your conclusions. In other words, to the unbeliever, or to the backslidden believer, what Jesus says in verses 24 to 28 will not make sense. It'll seem extreme to you. It'll seem drastic, excessive, fanatical, irrational, overkill, rigid. You can go to a thesaurus to find the other synonyms. But I hope you get what I'm saying. If you have the Peter problem, you too will think that those verses next are extreme. And you will shy away from even doing what Jesus says in 24 to 28, even as Peter did. Today, churches have the Peter problem. A.W. Tozer once said, "Christ calls men to carry a cross. We call them to have fun in His name." Jesus' cross, folks, was a source of entertainment only for those who mocked Him and crucified Him. So if you think that serving Christ is all fun and games and it's supposed to be entertainment, guess whose crowd you're putting yourself in? Those people in some circles would say, "But our methods draw crowds," and we're winning them. I appreciate A.W. Tozer on that statement, his sentiment. Listen to what he says. Winning them to what? To true discipleship? To cross-carrying? To self-denial? To separation from the world? To crucifixion of the flesh? To holy living? To nobility of character? To a despising of the world's treasures? To hard self-discipline? To love for God? To total commitment for Christ? Of course, the answer to all these questions is no. I say again, there's no more subtle tool of Satan to tempt you than well-meaning friends and relatives who care more for your comfort and theirs than they care about your walk with Jesus Christ. Jesus, there in verse 21, taught His disciples what He would do to save mankind. And now, in verses 24 to 28, He teaches His disciples what it would take to follow Him. And you'll notice the very first part of verse 24, after it says, Jesus said unto His disciples, "If any man will come after Me." And that's what I want you to leave this morning ringing in your ears. That statement, "If any man will come after Me." If any man will come after Me. If any man will come after Me. That's the title of this message. We see in verse 24, that first part, a disciple's desire, because Jesus is speaking to His disciples. Now, what is a disciple? A disciple is one who learns from another by instruction. In other words, a disciple is a student. A disciple is a pupil. So here is a student-teacher relationship. A disciple is one who follows another. He does not instruct the teacher and go before the teacher as Peter did. Jesus had to put him in his place and say, "You get behind Me. That's where you belong." A true disciple is instructed by the teacher and follows behind. He knows his place, even as a sheep to the shepherd, even as a servant to his master. If any man will come implies deliberate choice. And it literally means this: if any man desires to come. You see, Jesus does not force anyone to come after Him. Jesus compels. He does not coerce. He would not have you follow Him if you did so because you had to. He wants you to follow Him because you desire to. If any man will come after Me. If any man desires to come after Me. Matthew Henry in his commentary said, "Many are disciples more by chance or the will of others than by any act of their own will, but Christ will have His people volunteers." Some people are here this morning because somebody forced you to. Some may be here because somebody nagged you to. You're not here because you desire to be. You're here because you have to be. But here we see the disciples' desire. And Jesus says, if any man will come after me. That little phrase, come after me, is the same phrase Jesus uses when he says to Peter, get thee behind me. So it can be translated the same. If any man will come behind me. But the preceding verb is the key. There's the command to Peter, go away behind me. That's different than those desiring to come after me. Go away behind me is those who, like Peter, would tell Jesus that God's mercy means no suffering and no death. But Jesus, when he says, come behind me, is those who deny, take up, and follow. And thus we go from a disciple's desire in the first part of verse 24 to a disciple's discipline in the last part of verse 24. Let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. A disciple's discipline. Did you know that the word disciple is a root of the word discipline? Here's a little catchy phrase. No discipline, no disciple. No discipline, no disciple. You show me a person who does not like discipline, and I'll show you someone who was a poor disciple of Jesus. Because if you're going to come after him, it's going to take discipline. People believe in discipline for all kinds of things. Did you know that people believe in discipline for sports? You show me somebody who has this really strong desire to be good in whatever sport, and I'll show you somebody who's well-disciplined. Somebody who won't mind doing the push-ups and the pull-ups and the lunges and everything else in order to excel in that sport. People believe in discipline for sports. People believe in discipline for the military. Benjamin's finding that right now. What they put you through for that. People believe in discipline for music, at least those who succeed in it. Kayleen did not get good at the piano simply by sitting down one day and saying, you know what, I'm going to start playing. It required discipline and much practice. So it's interesting that people believe in discipline for everything, but not for Christ. A disciple's discipline. Notice that I did not say a disciple's disciplines, plural. I said a disciple's discipline, singular. Because what Jesus mentions here are not three different things that a disciple must do. Well, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. No one of those three can be true without the other two. All three together, although they're separately listed, describe a true disciple. So I might say it this way. Here are three components of a true disciple. He denies himself. He takes up his cross and he follows Jesus. And so his discipline, number one, is sacrificial. He denies himself. In fact, he must deny himself. Have you denied yourself any time this week? How about when you were on a diet and something was passed in front of you and you said, oh, that looks so good. And you said, but I can't do that. And you pass it on. And then the hostess, as they are so kind, says, oh, please. I spent hours laboring this week on this. You must have a piece of this. And you, with all your discipline, turn it down. Self-denial. Peter tried to get Jesus to spare himself. Jesus rebukes him and says, you must deny yourself. Do you think Jesus had to deny himself? Jesus, folks, is not asking his disciples to do what he himself would not do. And the tense of the verb, deny yourself, communicates that this is a one-time act. It doesn't mean that you don't have to deny yourself every day, but it's this determination, it's this decision that you make. It's a one-time decision. You say, I'm going to deny myself. because I want to come after Christ. I desire to follow Him. I am going to deny myself. It's not like the 40 days of Lent that implies that you can turn sacrifice on and turn sacrifice off. You talk to people who get involved in what they call Lent, and you'll find out what they do the night before. That's the night of Mardi Gras. That's Fat Tuesday, they call it. The last hurrah. Lent has no scriptural support. It is observed by Anglicans, Calvinists, Lutherans, Methodists, and Roman Catholics, but it's not in the Bible. I'll tell you what's in the Bible. It's not denying yourself for 40 days. It's always denying yourself. That's what Jesus said, deny yourself. You must deny yourself. And you know what? That's sacrificial. And all of us appreciate sacrifice, as long as it's someone else doing the sacrificing. A disciple's discipline is sacrificial. Secondly, a disciple's discipline is individual. The next thing Jesus says here is, take up his cross. He must take up his cross. Again, the tense of this verb says this is a one-time act. It's a one-time act, though, that requires daily practice, because Luke says this in Luke 9:23, take up his cross daily. So it is a one-time decision, but it is something that I must do daily. This is an individual discipline. Everyone's cross is different. My cross is different than my wife's cross, even with a married couple. I bear a cross that she does not. She bears a cross that I do not. The cross Jesus asks you to bear is individual. And the disciples were well aware of what it meant to bear a cross, because they had seen Roman crucifixions in Jerusalem. We tend to think that crucifixions didn't happen until Jesus was crucified. No, hundreds of thousands of people had been crucified prior to Jesus' crucifixion. It was common to make the condemned person carry to the place of execution the cross upon which he was to suffer. And so the disciples would readily understand the master's allusion here when he says, you take up your cross. And that's something you must do. Later on, after Jesus was raised from the dead, you'll find this in John chapter 21. They were standing there by the seashore of Galilee, and Jesus had some fish on the fire for them. And Jesus had asked Peter, says, Peter, lovest thou me? And three times Jesus asked that, and three times Peter said, Lord, thou knowest that I love you. And then there came a point when Jesus began to tell Peter what his future was going to involve. And you know what Peter did? He turned to John and said, Lord, what about him? Do you remember Jesus' reply? He said, what is that to thee? In other words, Peter, he's got his cross, you've got yours. What he bears is going to be different than yours. You know what some Christians do sometimes? They look at some Christians who seem to succeed and don't ever have problems and they never have trials. It seems like they never have a cross to bear. And we get jealous and we get bitter and we get angry. And yet, you know what? They have a cross to bear you don't know about. And you may have a cross to bear that they don't know about. I'm talking about a cross that is born for the sake of Jesus Christ. So, Jesus says to Peter, what is that to thee? It is individual. And then you know what he tells Peter next? Follow thou me. And that brings us to the third thing, the third component of this discipline. Follow me. Let him deny himself, let him take up his cross, and let him follow me. So this brings us to the third part of his discipline. It's not only sacrificial, individual, it is unforeseeable. Unforeseeable. What if I would tell you today, folks, follow me, and I started walking down the aisle, walked out the door, what would be one of your first questions? Help me out. Where are you going? Jesus says, follow me. Period. Where are you going, Lord? Follow me. So in other words, if I'm going to follow Him, what does it require? Faith. Trust. You deny yourself. You take up your cross. And follow me. It's unforeseeable. And the present tense here indicates that this is ongoing. You keep on following me. Folks, this discipline is not attractive for the one who wants an easy life. People who want an easy life would rebuke Jesus for thinking that he has to die on the cross to save men from sin. And he is also the disciple who is not thinking of the things of God. He is thinking of the things of men. To those kind of people, Jesus would say, just like he said to Peter, go away from me. Get behind me. I once saw a cartoon drawing. This is years ago. I don't know if you remember the big uproar there was in the Episcopal Church when they began to allow homosexual pastors. And I believe there was an Episcopal priest by the name of Robinson who began ministering in one particular Episcopal church. And there was a cartoon drawing in the newspaper that I saw. And in this cartoon drawing, there's people entering this church. And on the marquee, it says outside something about homosexual pastor today. Listen to this homosexual pastor. And you've got all these people entering the church and a whole bunch of sheep walking out. And it had this little verse under it. He goes ahead of them and his sheep follow him because they know his voice. I thought, you know, that's powerful. People are going in, but true sheep are getting out of there. Because that has nothing to do with Jesus Christ. Folks, a disciple's discipline of denying self, of taking up your cross and following Jesus is not attractive. It is not fun. So Jesus introduces in the next three verses the motive. Why would you want to do this? If it takes verse 24 to follow Jesus, no wonder so few people follow him. Who wants to deny themselves and take up their cross and follow him? No wonder so few are doing that. Why would anyone desire to come behind Jesus when it means self-denial, taking up your cross, and following him? And so we come to a disciple's decision in verses 25 to 28. This is not enjoyable. Hey, let me ask you this. Why would anyone desire to follow a healthy diet? I hate a healthy diet. I don't get near as much ice cream now as I used to. And I hate it. Why would anybody do that? Why would anybody follow a workout system when you work out and you're lifting weights and running and doing lunges and everything else, you come away so sore you're wondering, why did I do that? Why would anybody follow that kind of a regimen? I'll tell you why. It's the end result. That's why you would follow a diet. It's the end result. That's why you would follow a workout regimen, because of the end result. Let me ask you this. Why would anyone desire to shoot an elk 1,000 yards up a mountain in deep snow, climb up, cut that thing up, and carry 200 pounds of elk in snow over a mile until you're cold and frostbitten? Why would you do something so stupid? That's what Jesse did. At Barrick. Why would you do that? I'll tell you why. The end result. He said, this was worse than anything I've ever done in football. He said, if I would sell this meat, it goes for $100 a pound. Because when you endure something like that, and folks, I was there at the bottom of the mountain waiting for him. I was suffering too, but not like those guys. Why would Barak go frostbite? Why? The end result. I ask you, why would anyone want to come after Jesus? Why? It's self-denial. It's taking up your cross. It's following Him. Where's He going? I don't know. We know, looking back, He went to the cross. And it's the end result that Jesus gives as the motives. And all three of these things go against our natural thought processes. In other words, to an unbeliever or to a backslidden believer, these things found in verse 24 don't make sense. And so you're going to see the first word of verse 25. The first word of verse 25 says, out loud, please. And the first word of verse 26 says, and the first word of verse 27 says. So here we have three motives. Here's why you would want to deny yourself, take up your cross and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it, and whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. Here's why you would want to have the discipline of verse 24 for the experience of verse 25. I see in this verse a life destroyed. For whosoever will save or rescue his life shall lose it, or literally destroy it. And it's interesting that the word will in verse 25 is the same word will in verse 24. If any, for whosoever desires to save his life, he's going to lose it. Desiring to save or rescue your life from the discipline of verse 24 is a life that will be lost or literally destroyed or ruined. Now this goes against all of our natural thought processes. Wait a second. I've got to rescue myself. I've got to look out for number one. No, that's your problem. You're thinking this is number one. And in a Christian's life, who's number one? Folks, what you desire and do now has future consequences. It not only has consequences in this life, it has consequences in the life to come. I was reading an article some years ago. I had this in my files. It's entitled, this comes out of a missionary's kind of a publication, and they're reporting on what's going on in some missionary countries. And the title of this is, How Small Would Our Churches Be? Question mark. The following comes from a BIEM missionary in a Muslim land. Thursday, June 14th, we went with four candidates to a public beach here to have a baptism. This is in a Muslim country. When we got there, we found the beach crowded with hundreds of Muslim men and women. Immediately, one of our candidates began looking around with fear in his eyes. One could see him trying to count the cost in his own life. Sadly, he then looked at me and said, I can't do it. The other three, two young men and the pregnant wife of a Muslim man who attended to see his wife follow Christ's example, stood firm and shared beautiful testimonies of the gospel's transforming power in their lives and how Jesus Christ had saved them from a life too shameful to describe. Many eyes were on our strange group. Few, if any, understood what was taking place other than those who came to be witnesses to this beautiful event. The day was a great testimony to the goodness of God, His love and grace that reaches even into the Muslim world to save sinners. These brave young believers were ready to risk it all to have this blessed communion with their Savior. The onlookers from town did not interfere. They never have yet with us. I guess there is always a first time, but it hasn't found us yet. The candidate who backed out of being baptized stayed to watch the others. We talked with him late into the night and most of the following day. He said, "The teachings of Jesus are beautiful and good, but the shame is too much. If my family, friends, or co-workers find out, the cost is too great." We will continue to work with this young man and pray that he would truly come to Christ. And yet I rejoice that God purged him before the church was infiltrated by one who is not truly born again. And then he gives this sentence, "I can't help but wonder how small would our churches in the West be if we all had to walk this road." You say, that guy saved his life. No, that man destroyed his life. Jesus said, if any man wants to rescue himself, he's going to lose his life. So there's a life destroyed, but then we see a life discovered. Notice the last part, and whosoever will lose his life for my sake shall find it. This goes against our natural thought processes. Wait a second. If I lose my life, I will find it? Yeah, this is a life discovered. In the eyes of the world who think like Peter, to do what Jesus said in verse 24 is a lost life. It's a ruined life. But Lord, if I deny myself and take up my cross and follow you, my life is ruined. And this is the way a lot of young people think today. But not only young people, a lot of adults. If I do this, my life is ruined. But Jesus said, whoever will lose his life for my sake. And there's the key. Many men will lose their lives on the battlefield for their country's sake. Or somebody may jump in front of somebody else to take a bullet as a policeman in this world. And he may lose his life for the sake of that other individual. The promises for those who will lose their life for his sake shall find it. Shall find it. What does it mean to find it? I looked that word up, not in the dictionary, but in a Greek lexicon. And it means to learn something previously not known, to begin to experience. That's the key. To begin to experience. That's why I say that one who denies himself, takes up his cross, and follows Jesus, here's the motive for the experience. He will find his life. He will find it. Whoever wishes to save his bodily, temporal life shall lose his spiritual, eternal life. Now, this doesn't mean that you're going to lose your physical life. But I believe the man or the woman who is determined that they will go to the death for Jesus Christ, they have found life. From temporal to eternal. From bodily to spiritual. Here's the next end result that motivates us. It's found in verse 26. We would do it for the exchange. For what is a man profited if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? Question, for what in this world would you be willing to exchange for your soul? If you could have anything in this world, would you exchange your soul for that thing? Name it. What do you need in exchange for your soul? Would you really be willing to exchange it for your soul? There is nothing more precious than the human soul. What you have in this world is temporal. Everything about your body is temporal, but your soul is eternal. What would you be willing to exchange for it? Jesus says it this way. What is a man profited? What does he gain? If he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul, what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? I saw somebody write something once that said, even the richest and most powerful will share the same sized grave that you will have. I know there are people who say, what good is it to be a Christian? What good is it to be a follower of Christ? And then look at all the pleasures they would have to give up. They would ask, what good is it to spend your life on a mission field? What a waste. No, there's somebody who instead of saving their life is losing it for Christ's sake, and they're going to find it. What good is it to give up things for Jesus Christ? People would ask all of those questions. And then you imagine those same people at the end of their life on their deathbed and watch as somebody walks up to them and asks them, They've asked the questions before. What good is it? What good is it? What good is it? Now you ask them, what good is your wealth now? What good is it now to have had all that fun? Everything you lived for such a short time, it's now gone. And now, dear sir or dear ma'am, you are on the edge of eternity. And your soul will be lost forever. What good are those things now? You know of the man by the name of Jim Elliot, the missionary to Ecuador, who with his companions lost his life trying to minister to the Aka Indians of Ecuador. In 1956, their bodies were found. Jim Elliot had previously written, "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." What would you give in exchange? Someone tells the rich man in Luke chapter 16 who is in hell. Abraham says to him, "Remember that thou in thy lifetime receivest thy good things, and likewise Lazarus evil things, but now he is comforted and thou art tormented." Oh, what those people in hell today would give in exchange. What would they would give? We read that Moses chose rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a season, esteeming the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he had respect unto the recompense of the reward. Everything you can gain in this world, everything you could gain in Egypt, folks, is nothing compared to the coming reward. And that brings us to verse 27, and it's the expectation. Here we see that the end result that motivates is the expectation. Verse 27, "For the Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father with his angels, and then he shall reward every man according to his works." Here's the expectation. What should temper your desire for the things of this life? I'll tell you what should. Jesus is coming soon. Literally, if you were to read this verse, literally, it says this, "For the Son of Man is about to come." He is coming. And then, notice the last part of verse 27, and then what? What happens next? When he comes, then what happens? Then he shall reward every man according to his works, or he shall pay back each man according to his works. We find the same idea in Revelation 22:12, the last chapter of the entire Bible, where Jesus says, "And behold, I come quickly, and my reward is with me, to give every man according to his works." Every man, it says in verse 27, will receive a reward according to what? According to his works. Now, that's not the typical word for works in the Bible. In fact, we get our word praxis from that. P-R-A-X-I-S. So here's your vocabulary for Sunday today. Praxis. In fact, you could read it this way. "The Son of Man shall come in the glory of his Father and of his angels, and then he shall reward every man according to his praxis." I had to look that word up. I didn't know what praxis was. You know what praxis is according to the American Heritage Dictionary? It's habitual or established practice. It's custom. So every man is going to receive a reward according to his habitual or established practice, his custom. Every man is going to be rewarded according to his practice. There's another word related to praxis. It's praxeology. It's the study of human conduct. What I'm trying to emphasize is this. This has to do with our conduct, our customs, and what we practice in our lives. It's not what you did today that you'll never do again or then. It's your practice. What would somebody describe you as? What is your praxeology? What is the study of your human conduct? And so when you think about this word in this context, Jesus offers two ways to live in verse 25. You save your life, you live for yourself, or you ruin it for Jesus' sake, you live for Jesus. What is your praxis? the practice of some people is well established. Well, hearing God's word preached on Sunday, that conflicts with my regular Sunday practice. Very sobering verse is found, 2 Corinthians 5:10, for we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. Now, when it says, for we must all, Paul's including himself. This is talking about Christians. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body, according to that he hath done, whether it be good or bad, or literally worthless. Every one of us is going to stand before the judgment seat of Christ. And we're going to receive a reward according to the things done in our body. Verily I say unto you, verse 28, there be some standing here which shall not taste of death till they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. And we're not going to get into that, but the very next chapter is where three individuals, Peter, James, and John, see it happen. Peter later gives testimony to this in one of his epistles, and he said, we were there that day on the mount, and we saw him transfigured. We saw it. I end with this. Matthew not only writes his account of this, Mark has his parallel account of this passage, and Luke has his parallel. The synoptics have this passage in all three. But Mark and Luke make one additional sobering point. Here's how they conclude this. Listen to me. Here's what Jesus said. Right after he said verse 27 in Matthew, then he says this, for whosoever shall be ashamed of me and of my words, of him shall the Son of Man be ashamed when he shall come in his own glory and in his Father's and of the holy angels. I think of that Muslim man who said, I am too ashamed, I can't do it. When Jesus comes, if that man has not yet been saved, he will be ashamed of him. In the context, folks, being ashamed of Christ is exhibited by not denying myself. I am ashamed of him if I do not take up my cross. I am ashamed of him if I do not follow him. Can you imagine? I'm not going to follow him. That's because you're ashamed of him. And you're ignoring the end result. What good is it to deny myself and take up my cross and follow him? Because of the experience of saving your life. Exchanging what this world offers for what Christ offers. And the expectation of Christ's soon return and the reward he is bringing with him. That's what good it is. That's what good it is. Would you bow your heads? All heads bowed and eyes closed this morning.